once more under the breach, dear friends, else fill up the wall with our English dad. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. And that's normally Jeff and Jake McClure, but Jake is off in Colorado doing whatever people do this time of year in Colorado, being with friends and mostly trying to stay cool and stay unsweaty, which is something we do very poorly around here. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and one of the things that I need to tell you is that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program, which it is, it is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm that's headquartered in Salado, Texas. And the same guy, Jeff, that's talking on the radio right now, is also the same guy who is one of the principal advisors there. So there is definitely a correlation here that probably needs to be studied scientifically to determine how it works, but it's still there. And the information that we give on here, although we are an investment advisory firm, is not investment advice. It's educational. And investment advice is given to people individually based on their individual circumstances and cannot be mass-produced, which is, I guess, fortunate for us. The information we give on here is also things we have gotten from sources we deem reliable and quite consistent, things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, The Economist magazine. There's a series of places that like that and other sources that we have found over the years to be very reliable. They very rarely have to go back and say, nope, we were mistaken on that. And they certainly are proved not over time to be quite accurate. So we use them. And the information we give on here is also nothing to do with Town Square Media or KTEM. This is an independent program, and we express our own opinions, and we provide our own analysis, and they provide commercials to pay for the station and for us and all of that. So they have the commercials, we have the news and analysis that we do, and the two don't mix. Telephone number in here today, presuming that where you are and where I am is the same day with, is the 4th of August, 2018. Is 254-773-1400. And if you give me a call, I'll do my best. I'm in here solo, which means I have to throw a lot of switches in order to make things work, and I'm easily distracted, so we'll see if I can make it through the day. We do have a caller on 773-1400, and I'm going to do my best to put the caller on the air. So, caller, I think you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Try it and see. Are you there? Nope, that didn't work. Okay, I got both switches on. Are you there? Well, I'm obviously doing something wrong here. Ah, I was on the wrong thing. Okay. Instead of caller, it's this one, right?
Yeah, that'll be the line too.
Okay. All right, are you on the air, caller? I'm not getting anything. Okay, there you are. Are you on the air?
Hello?
Yes. This is the Personal Wealth Coach.
How much longer?
How much longer for what?
Okay. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, my question consists of gold, okay? This is what I don't understand about this. You get these places that set up, you know, they buy your gold scrap jewelry or whatever you have. The difference is this, what I don't understand. If you have like a pound of scrap jewelry, you know, necklaces, bracelets, and whatever, and you have a pound of a bar of gold, why would the bar of gold be worth more than the jewelry if they're both gold? Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thanks for calling. Well, there's a couple of answers to that. First off, your jewelry is not 100% gold, and it's going to have to be melted down and made into a bar of gold or made into ounces of gold to be sold as gold. And that's a process that is something that takes time to do, takes assaying. They'll look at your scrap jewelry and determine how much of it is gold, and they're going to give you what they believe is a fair market price, or they're going to give you the whatever price they're willing to pay for the gold, and you have to determine what you want to sell. The other thing is, When you see the price of gold, it's the price that is that it is offered on the market for sale. So if you had an ounce of gold and you were interested in selling your 1 ounce of gold, and you read, let's say you read our newsletter, and you determined that gold was at $1,221.90 as of Friday, and you went someplace and said, I want $1,221.90, they laugh at you. The reason is there has to be a spread between the buy and the sell on anything. There is no such thing as a free lunch. There's no such thing as a free transaction. If they're going to sell gold at $1,221, which is the spot price, not necessarily, and they probably will sell it a little higher than that, because it's at a retail level, then you're going to have to be willing to sell it to them for less in order for them to stay in business. You know, that is the nature of any transaction, is that the person in the middle, the broker, the buyer, or the deal, the market maker, in effect, has to have a spread. And the spread is always there. And any time that you're told that something is free, and the buy price and the sell price is the same, and there's no fee for selling, then immediately you should be suspicious and recognize that no company is doing business for free. Nobody does business for free. And because they just simply wouldn't be in business very long. There's a few people who have tried over the years. Tesla is trying, in essence, to sell their cars for a little less than than it costs to make them, and they're working really, really hard to get the cost of making the cars down to the point where they can afford to sell their cars on the open market at a price that people can reasonably afford to pay. In order to do that, they have to get up to a certain volume of cars manufactured per month, around 10,000 a month, or they're just not going to get, they won't be profitable, and they're hoping to get profitable in the near future. The same thing is true when you buy and sell gold. The same thing is true when you buy and sell corn. If you look at what a bushel of corn sells for, and then you look at what a farmer gets for a bushel of corn, you'll discover the farmer is going to get less for the bushel of corn when he sells it than it would cost somebody to turn around and buy a bushel of corn. That's just the reality of whoever it is that stores the corn, sorts it, looks at it, rates it, and does all the things that have to be done. They've got to make some money too. So this is the nature of what goes on in the world. And I hope that's a good answer to your question. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone numbers in here is 254-773-1400. And we had a week. We indeed had a week. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index was up about 0.75% for the week, which actually was pretty good, all in all. And we got a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello? Obviously, I'm not as smart as the telephone system here. And I probably have somebody on there that can hear me and I can't hear them. Is there anybody there? Okay, well, I've got to wait for the technician to return before I can figure out how to answer the telephone, apparently. I thought I had answered the telephone correctly. Are you there? Hello, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Okay, well, obviously I'm doing this wrong, and obviously I don't have anybody here to help me, so I'm not doing this the way it needs to be done. Does that help any? Let's see. Nope, not getting anything. Not for lack of trying. And I'm obviously throwing some switch wrong somewhere. Ah, there we got it. But whoever it was went away, and that makes perfectly good sense in a strange sort of way. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and you want to give me another try, it's 254-773-1400, and we'll make another shot at answering the phone. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. You're on the air.
There you go. Thank you, sir.
Good.
Enjoy the show. On the Wall Street today about jobs market math, want to keep adding up. mentioned that the participation rate's in the mid 60%. Mike, I'm curious. I know that'll never be 100% participation in the job market, but what are the other 35% of the people out there that want to work waiting for?
And they're not they don't want to work. That's the point. Yeah, that is a key in your question. When the job participation rate is 62.5%, which I think it is right now, then the 37.5% of the people who are not in the job market are people who don't want to work. As an example, my wife is actually old enough now that she no longer would be considered to be an eligible person, so she wouldn't be in it. But let's just say that any time that you have a couple where a husband and wife are together, and this is a classic example that I can tell you about, and the wife says, I'm staying home taking care of the kids and raising kids, I consider that to my job, and the husband says, that's cool, I'm going to go to work. Well, then that wife is eligible to be in the job market, but is not in the job market, and that's that 37% that's not in the job market. Another group of people that are not in the job market are people who are already retired, but they're younger than 65. I think the age range goes through 65 now. It used to go through 60, but I think it goes through 65 now. And there's other people, of course, who, for other reasons, are not in the job market. You could have a something-year-old person who was living with their parents and who chooses not to work at this point. And that person, even if they're old enough to be in the job market, but they choose not to be in the job, not to go to work, they're part of that 37%. And it's really not radically different from what it used to be. We used to have a job participation rate in the United States many years ago that was below 50%. Then women entered the market, and the numbers went up and up and up. And in the 1990s, they were in the upper 60s, which is as high as we've ever seen them. Now they're down to about 62%. Why the difference? Of course, if you want to be political and you want to look at it this way, you can see there's a bunch of lazy people out there. But I don't think so. Among other things, there are quite a substantial number of retirees in the United States who are not 65 yet. They have simply made enough money along the way that they choose at this point not to work. There's another group of people, a pretty large group of people, who are in their 50s and 60s mainly. They're mostly white, and they have back problems, or they have an opioid addiction because of medications they've taken because of pain, or a host of other reasons that they're no longer in the job market. There is some degree of illness issues here in older people. It's not really that unusual, but we're counting those people as being willfully unemployed and not part of the job market. When we look at the unemployment numbers that came out, what we're seeing is among the people who say, I would like to work, we're approaching a pretty near record number of them being able to work. There are certainly some pockets in the United States, and Detroit is one of the more famous pockets right now, where there are a significant number of people who would like to work, but the jobs simply aren't available for them to work. The backside to that is, in any number that you want to look at, the number of job openings in the United States now dramatically exceed the number of people who are unemployed. And it's going to stay that way going forward unless we do something pretty radical to fix it. And that is, by the way, an indication of an economy hitting its natural limits. Any growth organism or any growth organization has certain constraints on its growth. And those are bottlenecks. Those are what's called capacity utilization issues when you talk about economics. And we are definitely up against, in the labor market, hitting some capacity utilization issues. A couple of interesting things about the labor, since you asked about the job participation rate, about the report that came out this week, and it's underlying a fundamental reality. We're still seeing year-over-year job We're seeing wages growing at 2.7%. And that is considerably less than we saw, for instance, in the 1990s, when we had a 4% growth in wages at this level of unemployment. And there's a lot of questions, why is that so? And I read a really good analysis in the Financial Times that explained it, I think, exceptionally well, and I've seen the similar analysis in other places. And that is, the people who are leaving the job market, who are retiring, are generally fairly well paid. They're people who have worked for 30 or 40 years, and they are very, very good at what they do, and they leave the market, and they retire. And there's a lot of that going on because the baby boomer bubble is in the position of retiring as it comes up now. They have, particularly with the surge in the stock market, we've seen some significant improvements in wealth in the United States since 2009. We've seen 401ks that have grown dramatically. We've seen personal wealth grow dramatically. There's a lot of noise made about that, some of it positive, some of it negative. But it boils down to the fact that there are a lot of people out there who can afford to retire, and they're retiring, and they're older, and they're generally very well paid. That's something that we really accept across the board. Now, who's being hired? Well, the people that are being hired, and there's a lot of people being hired. We had 157,000 net hired in the United States last month. Now, that was a little disappointing because the consensus was around 190 or 200,000 that they thought were going to be hired. Then there's been some degree of noise about the fact that 157,000 is disappointing, and it is a little bit disappointing if you're looking at it month to month. If you're looking at a three-month average, though, which is the shortest average I would recommend you look at for unemployment and hires and fires and everything else, because the numbers surge back and forth month to month sometimes, we're averaging 224,000 a month, which is a lot more people than are coming into the workforce new out of school each month. And, of course, the Labor Department has to make some seasonal adjustments for that because there's a surge of new people enter the market at the end of the school year each year. And there's other times when it tends to surge up and down. They look at the history and they try to balance that out so we get some reasonable numbers. And so we had 157,000 net job gains in July, and we look at that and we say that's not a great deal. But there were revisions. Remember, the first time that the Department of Labor or the Department of Commerce comes out with a number in the economy, it's an estimate, and it is almost always subjected to at least two major revisions later on. With the estimate for July's hiring at 157,000 came about 60,000 more jobs identified from the previous 2 months. So you could, in effect, say it was over 200,000 people that got hired. It's just that some of them got hired 1 and 2 months ago. Well, who's being hired? And it's pretty clear who's being hired are younger workers who are just entering the job market for the first time, and older workers who are re-entering the job market and previously were not part of the people we consider to be in the market at all. So what we've seen is the labor participation rate gradually creeping upward, and it doesn't sound like, I mean, the difference between 62 even and 62.7, it doesn't sound like a great big jump. It is when you look at the size of the total labor market, and it explains largely where a couple of things are going on. One, why our participation rate, it moves very slowly because it's a really big number we're working with. It also explains why wages are going up very slowly because we're looking at average wages. By the way, if we look at low-end wages, people who don't have a college education and people who don't even have a high school education, we are seeing the fastest growth, around 4 to 5% a year in that area. There is a shortage of relatively unskilled labor in the United States, and it's very clear that companies are having to raise wages to get those people to come to work, and they, in order to keep the people they have to raise the wages for the people they have. So, interestingly enough, at the upper end of the scale, where you hear so much about the 1% and the 5% and the 20%, the wage raises this year and in the previous year have been minuscule to non-existent. Now, everybody felt like they got a little bit of a kick early this year.
3 minute stations, 3 minutes to you.
Because the tax cut went in. And once the tax cut hits, obviously, we are in a position where we have more money in our paycheck, so we feel like we got a little bit of a raise. But in fact, the Labor Department is pretty clearly showing what's going on. So if we get no wage growth at the upper end, where the big money is already being made, and we get about a 4 or 5% wage growth at the bottom end, then what we're seeing is that the total wage growth, because there's a lot more lower-end people than higher-end people, goes up at about 2.7 per year. And that is really, given the circumstances we're looking at, not bad at all. Once it goes up above 3%, and I think it will, then we'll start to see some effects on inflation, and we'll start to see people with more money to spend. Interestingly enough, the inflation rate is running about 2%, and wages are going up at about 2.7. Sounds pretty good. The problem is, of course, that the people at the bottom were barely making enough money to get by before, and now they're gradually moving into a position where they can start to spend a little more of that money, and we'll begin to see a little more stimulus hit the economy from that as time goes by. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and again, the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. This is KTM 1400, and we're going to, of course, play some commercials and then be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with a Personal Wealth Coach and a guy who is obviously not very adept at controlling what comes over the air when it comes over the air. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number is in here. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. Presuming that today is August 4th, Jeff McClure is in here by himself, alone, who hasn't run the control board in a long time. And it's kind of showing in my inability to do it very effectively. Let's see, what we were talking about a little earlier is what happened in the market this week. The probably the most important thing to understand is that the market was up about this S&P 500 was up about 0.75%. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but if you multiply that times 52 weeks, it becomes a really impressive number. It becomes a world-breaking, record-breaking market. Importantly, though, the S&P 500 has now risen, not a lot, hasn't surged upward, but it has risen for five consecutive weeks, and that's the first time it's done it since the tariff wars, or the trade wars, started in February. It's been fighting back and forth, like across the board in the markets. There's a pretty clear battle going on between the bulls, who believe that the stock market will triumph and do wonderful things because earnings will go up and earnings will continue to rise. And indeed, the earnings that we've seen reported by corporations in the S&P 500 so far for the second quarter are running at about 20% above where they were last year. And are 20% above, about 17% above last year, and about 20% above what we saw the quarter before. So what we're seeing is a distinct increase in corporate profitability. Now, here's the question, and there's been a lot of discussion on this. How much of that corporate profitability came because of the tax cut? And how much is there because of the economy, the underlying economy, going like gangbusters? The underlying economy is indeed going at about the maximum effective speed that can get, which means that has something to do with it, that is certainly affecting the increased earnings that we're seeing in companies. But at the same time, we got a tax cut, and the tax cut filters through in lots of different ways into corporate earnings. And let me give you an example. Not only do corporations pay lower taxes, which obviously raise their net earnings, and they report that differential, they also are in the position where if they buy equipment, they get to immediately write it off, which explains why manufacturing is doing very well in the United States right now. Another thing that pops up, and this is one of the great ironies, at least I think, is that because of the tax cuts to businesses, the biggest, not only are their income tax rates down to 21% from previously about 35% maximum rate, they also get to write off 100% of the cost of anything they buy. Now, historically, there's a very complex set of depreciation rules in the Internal Revenue Code for different types of equipment. For instance, if you buy a computer, let's say you spend $1,000 or $2,000 or $5,000, whatever. Let's say you spend $5,000 on a computer and you're in a business. And believe me, you can spend $5,000 easily on a computer in a business. Then your tax write-off this year isn't $5,000. You don't get to deduct $5,000 from your revenues this year. You get to deduct $1,000 and then $1,000 the next year and $1,000 the next year because there's a five-year depreciation schedule on a computer. And that means you have to spread, previously, you had to spread out the cost that you spent to buy that computer over a five-year period. New tax law changed that. The new tax law says you can expense it, it's called, in the year you buy it. So you spend $5,000 on a computer, you knock $5,000 off your taxes this year, which is a big deal for corporations and companies. And it's always a big deal when you can, in essence, it lowered the cost of buying a computer. It lowers the cost of buying furniture. It lowers the cost of doing everything except, and this was an accident, improving the building that you do business in, or expanding the building, or making renovations to the building. Inadvertently, there were some words left out of the tax law because it was rushed through. And that isn't deductible anymore, except unless you spread it over a 39-year period, which is a little absurd. And so you've got this tax break that's written into the system. You've also got a tax break that's written into your paycheck. So people have more money to spend, and corporations have more money to spend. Here's where the bears come in and take a look at it and say, wait a minute, this is a surge in profitability for several reasons. One is that corporations are paying less taxes. Another one is corporations buy a lot of stuff from other corporations. If you bought that computer, let's say you bought it from Dell or Hewlett-Packard or whoever you bought it from, and although Dell's no longer publicly traded, but whoever you bought the computer from is seeing a surge in business because a lot of people now can write off their computers in 1 year. So if they had a need, a pent-up need, they said, my computer is getting old, I'm thinking about buying a new computer, and then all of a sudden they get the opportunity to get a complete tax deduction for buying the computer, that makes them more likely to buy the computer. If they get an opportunity and it's a major corporation and they get the opportunity to bring home the money from overseas, pay the tax on it, whether you bring it home or not, so you got might as well bring it home and spend it on something, well, then you're likely to go out and buy the things that you've been kind of maybe thinking about buying. So you get another surge from that. You get a third surge from the fact that your customers now have more money in their pockets to spend on computers and so on. And since the market is largely priced and the earnings come from changes from previous earnings. Growth rates. In other words, a 20% growth rate in earnings indicates that everything is rosy and wonderful on the surface until you step back and take a look at the distortions that have been injected into the system by the change in the tax code. Those distortions won't stay there. You can say, well, the taxes are not going back up. True. But remember, it's changes in earnings that generates rises in stock prices. And if a lot of the things that went on as a result of the tax law change are concentrated in a very small time period, like one or two quarters, then investors in the market are not going to get too excited about it, because once they're done, they're done. They're gone. Once that pent-up demand for computers that got filled because people got to do a lot of write-offs is satisfied, the reason there's a depreciation schedule of 5 years on computers is because typically companies tend to keep a computer about 5 years and they say it's outmoded, I need another one. So there's going to be a tremendous surge, which may go on into the third quarter, because these things are slow to take effect. So we have a tremendous surge in earnings and a tremendous surge across the board because of a tax law change that occurred at the beginning of the year. The issue then is that all of this surging, all of this activity, will almost certainly not continue into the indefinite future. So the investors in the market, the professional investors, are looking at that and saying, we don't want to bid the stocks up because we're going to get a little, if we think this level of earnings is normal, we're probably going to get a disappointment next quarter or the next quarter or maybe a year from now, but we're going to get a disappointment. And it's burning through a lot of the capacity. It's burning through a lot of the things that are going on out there. And there's another aspect to it. Because of this high demand, prices went up. And you don't see prices going up across the board. You don't see consumer prices shooting upward. But you do see, what we are seeing is what's called the producer price index rising considerably faster than the consumer price index. This indicates that the people who make things are paying more for what they use to make things and more for raw materials than they otherwise would. Again, when you get a surge in demand, it causes prices to rise. It causes the recipients of those things, that the people who are selling the stuff, to see a big increase in earnings. It causes the people who are buying them to pay extra for it, but it's masked. It doesn't show up in their profitability statements too much because we had a big tax cut. All of this is pretty complicated, but it is pretty well understood by the professional investment community that, to quote Moody's Analytics, the economy's on a sugar high. And a sugar high is followed by a crash at some point. So that's why we see the market only up about 6-point-something% this year. Matter of fact, let's see, the market was up 3.6% since the quarterly earnings started this year, but earnings are up about 20%. It's up 6.24% in 2018. Even though earnings are well up, well over 20% increase in earnings so far this year in corporations, but the market's only up 6.24%. Why? Well, because investors consider the earnings surge that we're seeing right now to be temporary and transitory, which should give us pause and cause us to think about it just a little bit when we look at the market in general. That has a lot to do with another thing that happened this week that I think is very important. Certainly not a minor issue. And that is that Apple became the first company in the history of the United States to have a market valuation of $1 trillion. I want to talk about that at some length. Again, this is that is a big benchmark. It's a big mark in the history of what goes on in the big wide world. I don't think this is going to be in the long term, other than a first, a significant number. And the reason is it's only a matter of time until Google gets up there, and maybe Facebook will recover and get back up there. And Microsoft's intrinsic value, according to, and I'm not recommending you go out and buy Microsoft, intrinsic value at Microsoft, according to most analysts, is $1 trillion. Which means that its stock is a little bit undervalued compared with the rest of the market. That doesn't necessarily mean that it will go up from here, so I'm not recommending that you go out and buy Microsoft or something. But I think what we'll see is, down the road, $1 trillion companies occupying the upper tier of the S&P 500 to be pretty normal. And that is an indication of just how resilient and how strong our economy is. Now, we may see a surge above a trillion for a while and then a fallback. That's the way historically things typically tend to work out. And then from there, I wouldn't be surprised to see that we stabilize at a higher level. Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is KTEM. And we have some more commercials to play. And so we're going to play some commercials for KTEM and for Town Square Media. And we'll be back on the other side. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400, presuming that it is still August 4th, Saturday, where you are and we are together, and this is not a rerun playing at some other time in the distant future. And we were talking a little bit about the market, which is coming up fairly nicely. It's a very respectable 6-plus percent so far this year, which is really a very healthy response. It's up about 14% from this time last year. The 10-year Treasury, which is something that I follow pretty closely, it's an indicator of what the bond market thinks about what's going on. During the week, it got up to around 3%. And a rise in the Treasury interest rates indicate a couple of things. It indicates that there's not a tremendous, it either indicates there's not a tremendous number of people who are buying Treasuries, which wasn't the case in this instance, or it indicates that those who are buying Treasuries are expecting greater economic growth in the future if interest rates go up. They demand more interest, more money, more interest when they buy Treasuries, to buy the 10-year Treasury. In other words, they're saying, I'm going to loan you money for 10 years. And in the middle of the week, they were saying, I want 3% per year interest compounded on this, or I'm not going to loan the money to you. Now, a couple of years ago, or even a year ago, they were saying 1%. So 3% is a really big jump in the amount they want. It slid back down below 3% towards the end of the week. And the battle there is just like the battle in the market. Were it not for the trade wars that are going on, then I don't think there's any question that we would see much higher interest rates out at the long end of the curve, out at 10 years and plus, than we're seeing right now, because there would be an expectation that we will that there will be higher interest rates in the future because there'll be more business activity, which means more people want to borrow money, which means interest rates will be higher in the future. Up in the upper twos is a pretty comfortable number. It is actually lower than what would normally be expected at this point. The reason I say that, if inflation is running a little over 2%, and it is, by any measure that we want to put out there, what people are saying is we only want a 1% differential between inflation as it's running today and what we'll loan you money for the next 10 years. Not a bad trade-off, but nothing particularly exceptional, because it means that the people who are buying Treasuries are not expecting much inflation, and they don't expect a massive run-up in the economic activity over the next decade. And so they're willing to settle for something less than 3%. If you see this number start to go up higher, faster, there's a couple of indications there. One is that the bond market is expecting more and faster economic growth in the future. And the second one is once that number starts to go up, it means the value of the Treasuries are going down. It means fewer people are buying them. So far, we're not seeing any of that go on. We're seeing every indication. As a matter of fact, all the leading economic indicators continue to say the same thing, that we will have a very healthy economy for the next 6 months to a year. That's as far out as leading economic indicators can actually forecast. But they're strong enough at this point that one could reasonably assume, unless there's something goes on that's not in the cards right now, we will probably go through most or all of 2019 with a very healthy economy. Towards the end of 2019, it starts to get problematic. The same thing, the leading economic indicators are starting, the growth in the numbers in the leading economic indicators, not the numbers themselves, but the growth in the numbers is starting to level off. This is the kind of thing that happens when we're approaching the peak in the economy? Is the strength of the rise in those leading economic indicators starts to level off? It's lower now than it has been for several years, which is an indication that we are growing closer to the end of our ability to grow the economy. All the indicators are saying the same thing. And you don't even have to read the national indicators to tell that we're getting close to the capacity utilization of the capacity of our economy. All you have to do is get on I-35 and try to drive it on a Friday night or much of any other time, and you see that there is that one of the restrictions that we're running into the economy that's very obvious, and this is classic economics, is the ability to transport goods and services from one place to another. If you sell a product, somebody's going to buy it, and they're not walking into the store to buy it, that you made it in the same store, which is pretty unusual, then somewhere it's got to get on a truck and go to where it can be sold or go to the person who bought it. And as I was driving in today, there was a small accident in between Temple and Belton, and they were, I think, they'd either blocked the highway on one lane or only letting one lane go by, and trucks were backed up for miles and miles and miles. And this is becoming more and more common. Matter of fact, in the process of trying to drive in and out of Austin on a regular day, not during rush hour, it's routine now to encounter a traffic jam, or at least a major traffic slowdown. And this is despite the fact we've gone from a four-lane highway to a six-lane highway. And if you look at the number of trucks that are in that traffic jam, and you recognize that those trucks have goods on there that will not arrive when they were scheduled to arrive, you realize we're starting to get a slowdown, literally, in the delivery of goods in the system because we're reaching the capacity of the highways. The railroads are pretty much in the same condition. There's a shortage of truck drivers. There's a shortage of trucks. But I think if we got full, we got all the truck drivers we wanted and we got all the trucks we wanted, we still wouldn't have the infrastructure that we need to move things around in the country. And frankly, one of the issues that during the presidential election everybody seemed to agree on was that we needed about $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion investment in infrastructure in the United States in order to sustain a reasonable rate of growth into the future. And that kind of got buried in the rush of let's do a tax cut and let's try to repeal Obamacare and tariffs. Fact is, we are at or near capacity utilization in a lot of places in the United States. And this is what the economists like Jake and I look at very, very hard, and we say, As hot as things are going right now, they can't continue to grow at this rate because there's a limit to how far we can go with what we have without a lot of investment in infrastructure. And we're not seeing the investment in infrastructure, so we're going to hit the capacity utilization. We're going to hit a wall somewhere down the road. Of course, trying to figure out where that wall is what we do for a living as much as anything else. Telephone number in here again. This is KTEM. And I'm Jeff McClure, and this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and it's Saturday, August 4th. And if it's Saturday, August 4th where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 773-1400, area code's 254, and we'd be glad to talk to you. Let's see what else is going on out there. Apple's $1 trillion. Let's talk about that just for a second. And let's see where we are in history. That's one of my favorite subjects is where are we in history? Because history, as Mark Twain said, doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it rhymes. And what we've been following in the 21st century is a pretty much economically a lockstep with what happened in the 20th century, which is not that different from what happened in the 19th century. And the reason I say that, there's a book called The Panic of 1907, and if you read it carefully and you're very familiar with what happened in 2008, you would just think it was some kind of fiction where the events that occurred leading up to and including in the panic of 1907, the stock market panic, are so similar to what happened in 2008 that it is kind of astonishing. It was banks that led the crash, and the banks had made a lot of loans on real estate that didn't turn out to work well. And they started having to foreclose on loans and realized that the real estate they were foreclosing on was worth less than they were trying to foreclose than they could get for it by selling it on the open market. So what had been a big bubble in real estate collapsed very quickly, left the banks holding the bag, and there are a lot of banks that started to go out of business. And if enough banks go out of business, the economy gets into a great deal of trouble in a hurry, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But the bottom line to it is money in a society is created by banks. That's just a simple fact. And if banks go out of business, then we stop creating money. If we stop creating money, we get deflation. And deflation is what's the definition of a depression. And we saw that happen in the 1930s as banks went under right and left, and we got a depression. We were rescued from that, in effect, in 2008, just as in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt and J.P. Morgan got together and figured out how to rectify the situation by the government loaning a lot of money to banks for the in the short term and buying their stocks directly, which was a very unusual behavior for the government at the time. It was literally gold they were using. And it worked, and it worked very, very well. It headed off the crisis. That's not to say that there wasn't a recession at the time. There was a pretty good recession. But still, they headed off the crisis and continued on forward. We'll talk about that some more. There's a really powerful parallel with what's happened in Apple and what happened in the 20th century. We'll talk about that next hour. We're out of time at the first hour. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is also an investment advisory firm that does wealth management and investment management for higher net worth people. And you can reach us off the air at 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-PLAN. That's 1-800-914-7526. Or you can email me, Jeff, at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. So until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.